Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of That Anthro Podcast. I'm really happy that you're choosing to listen to my podcast, whatever time of the day it may be where you are. Today we have Dr. Murray Cook, who is born and raised Scot, and he is a Scottish archaeologist. He works on both the commercial and the research side, and he runs a field school, all of which are things we're going to talk about today. And the beginning of my saying hello to him and introducing people to the podcast got cut off because I didn't have the best reception. When it rains here, the reception in our house gets terrible. But I wanted to introduce the episode and say a big thank you to Dr. Cook for coming on the podcast. It means a lot when people, you know, especially international folks, devote their time to having an interview with me. It means a lot. So I know you're really going to enjoy this episode. And I'd like to also say thank you to a former guest of the podcast, Griffin Fox, who attended Dr. Cook's field school this summer, for connecting the two of us. Yeah, without further ado, let's get into the episode.
Well, thanks for that, Gabby. And please, just Murray, no problem at all.
All right.
Looking forward to this.
Awesome. Well, the first thing I have a question about is your history with getting your degree in anthropology, but also, have you lived your whole life in Scotland?
Yeah, I mean, I've lived my whole life more or less within a kind of 30-40 mile area from where I was born. Scotland's a very small place. Whenever I have friends from America, Canada, Australia coming, and they say, oh, can we go to Orkney? And it's about a 3-4 hour drive, absolute minimum. And that feels like a long way.
Yeah.
So it's always this contrast with anybody from a much bigger country. So no, Scotland's a tiny place, but lots to do. And yeah, no need to move anywhere, really. Though, you know, I've had a few jobs, but no, I've always lived in Scotland, really. Undergrad was in archaeology, not anthropology. We a big difference. That was in Edinburgh. Then I worked in the profession for kind of 10, 12 years, and decided to do a PhD. And that was again at Edinburgh because I did it a particular route. I did research by research publication. So I did the work first, published it all, and then submitted a body of work to Edinburgh for consideration. I'd done the work, but I did it in a year. So I summarized it all. And I could do that at Edinburgh because I was an Edinburgh undergraduate. So it's quite a good system.
Yeah. And I think the whole like publishing articles as a PhD dissertation is becoming more and more common, even here in the States. And I really like it. I think it's a really great way to get people started on their building their academic profile, like right from the PhD. Did you feel that way?
Well, it was a question of I'd done the work because what was happening? I was a manager in a kind of archaeological consultancy, so I was doing less and less field work. And I thought, oh, I really would like to do some. So engineered the field schools, and I did 2 weeks a year on with an overarching research strategy, and then eventually that was of sufficient merit to warrant the PhD. But mm-hmm. equally, PhD by publication is a fraction of the price. So mm-hmm. I paid £1,500 for the PhD, which I think is about the cheapest one you can do.
Yeah.
I can imagine. The downside is I have no teaching experience. So while I've got a PhD, I'm not getting any kind of access to departments, because I think they're looking for that teaching element, which of course you do if you do the kind of normal mm-hmm. 3-4 years, and you're always covering classes, you're marking essays. So there was a downside, but it was really for me rather than some kind of career hurdle, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like now with your field school that you mentioned you're running, you're probably getting a lot of that teaching experience. So hopefully that will kind of contribute.
Well, I hope so. The thing is, I think I have a good work balance, and I'm not certain what I would gain from being more formally in academia, which, I mean, on this side of the kind of Atlantic, lots of archaeology departments are closing. Mm-hmm. And it feels like a lot of hard work, whereas the field school element, the basically almost like a straightforward contract arrangement. People come, dig on a good site, that pays for all the costs associated with the publication, the post-excavation, and I'm basically doing the job without the form filling.
And the grading.
You know. Yeah, exactly. So I'm quite happy at the moment with my wee patch and wee setup.
Yeah. What inspired you to start the field school, and how long have you been running it for?
Well, the kind of original inspiration was to find a mechanism to fund research. I'd done a very large series of excavations, which had a couple of monographs, and you know, in a typical development fashion, they were primarily concerned with the development plot. So material outside the development plot, we couldn't dig. Fantastic sequence from the Mesolithic through to the medieval. But all the gaps in the sequence were around the wider landscape. So I started to kind of apply to dig the missing sites 2 weeks a year. And so there was the inspiration. And, you know, gradually it was easier to ask people to contribute to the project than it was to apply for the funds. Mm-hmm. And also I found that I enjoyed meeting new people, kind of been passing on my enthusiasm for digging, and actually just you meet different people every single year. So they kicked off around 2005, and I even ran them through COVID, although lots of disinfectant and the odd mask. But as I say, 10, 15 articles, the PhD, and at least one monograph. Two monographs have come out of all the work, so that's quite good fun.
And by monograph, you mean a book, right?
So I would describe a monograph as a book, but a technical book. So it describes the results of the excavation, whereas maybe a book I might say was more synthetic, so summarizing other people, you know, a broader period. I mean, both are available free to download, and maybe I'll email you with the links. You can put them on the
I'll have them in the description.
They're publications of record. So rather than they do synthesize the period under concern on the site, but it's lots of raw data. So
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, new term for me. I learned just as much on the podcast as the listeners do, but I think that that's part of the fun. So when you have students working on the field site, what's their first day like? What are you introduce them to? Do you do a history of the area? Do they just start digging right away? Because I think like lots of people that are listening, we have an audience of a lot of undergrads. So I kind of want to prepare them for what a first day or days on field school might look like.
Well, the first 20 minutes is always carrying the tools.
Oh, of course.
Carrying the tools to site. Starts with the histories of the site, the basics of health and safety. You know, don't lift the spade above your head. Don't lift more than you can carry. And I try to figure out who knows what, because there'd be some people who know absolutely nothing. Some people have dug for years. Some people want to brush up the skills. So we try and kind of filter out who knows what experience people have had, and thus kind of come up with a specific program for each individual. But inevitably, the dig moves from deturfing to troweling to recording to backfilling. And what happens is that some people will say, can I do some photography? I just want to sieve. I just want to dig. And, you know, that range of experiences, range of choice that an individual makes. So if people want to do one particular aspect, that's what they focus on. And then within lots of the field school, I kind of, every now and again, well, it's actually not every now and again, I have between one and five people on longer term placements with me. And what they do is they come to more than one dig. And I talk them through more of the process. So that is before and after. So we get involved in the design of the project and the writing up the project. And sometimes it forms a thesis topic. So, you know, a few students have done short-term, long-term placements with me. And I should say, when I'm not doing the field school, I do I work for a local authority in Scotland, commenting on planning applications for development. So I get people to help with that as well. So we get a kind of a broad range of both the research and the commercial sides in Scotland. And I was just thinking, someone has been working with me for 2 years through their undergraduate. I had someone else who graduated last year who did 4 years worth, and she would just come to every dig. Our thesis topic was one of the sites we dug together. Her name will be a co-author on the publication. You know, it's a good way to learn, because you go back and you repeat and you repeat and you repeat, you know, and it's great to learn. But there's so much going on. There's new names, there's a new place, there's new techniques, that you always forget something. So you have to go back over things, you know, draw the section again, talk about context recording, talk about stratigraphy, you know, how to clean, how to clean up soil, why you shouldn't use a brush. And, you know, that steady repetition of things, I think, is what you need to kind of hit the ground running. If you're looking for a job in it, if you're looking to be a researcher, well then, or in academia, you need the publications. So again, there's an element, if you can get, start writing, which I do all the time. So.
And that commercial side is kind of like, for anyone that's listening, it's kind of like what I imagine CRM is like here in the States, in that it's consulting. Every time something new is being built, there's survey and sometimes excavations that go on before a building or a parking lot can be put down.
Exactly the same thing. So my role is to develop a spec. If there's something of interest, and then that's tendered out to commercial contractors and they do it. So it, yeah, CRM over the other side of the Atlantic, and we just call it contracting and consulting. So you know, exactly the same thing.
Yeah. So currently, what sites are you working at, or what projects are you working on that we can talk about?
Oh, well, loads. I've just been digging an early medieval church boundary. So this is Pictish, dating to around 700 AD. It's called Logie Old Kirk. And the name there, we think, is a corruption of locus from the Latin. So the place, probably meaning the holy place. And when churches are so rare, they don't necessarily have names, just the Latin phrases. And this, we think, is founded circa AD 700 as the kind of Pictish ruling classes defeat the kingdom of Northumbria, push their boundary south, and as well as a political reorganization, they bring a religious reorganization. And they found a number of, they found churches, they have a royal cult, and all this happens. And then this church stops being important 300-400 years later, but we have, now we call them Viking hogbacks. They're not really Viking burials, but they're kind of stone burial monuments in a Viking tradition or a Viking inspiration. So there are about four of these at Logie. So we think it's important between AD 700 and AD 1000, 1100, and then drops, its political significance drops, and it's just another bog standard church. So this one we've been digging the northern boundary, and I've been doing this with I run a college night class as well, and we're digging that with the students from there to try and see if we can spot an earlier boundary. We've got 500-year-old pottery. We think we've got the 500, 600-year-old boundary outside the 19th century boundary. And then beyond that, there's something else. But we keep running out of time, small seasons. So that's quite good. A thing I've been working on for 3 years, which is very exciting, is a very, very extensive piece of rock art, multi-period rock carving. And at one end, there are quern rough outs. So, you know, a rotary quern for grinding corn.
Yeah.
And so we think that those are Iron Age to medieval. It's also got cup mark stone, so the kind of late Neolithic, early Bronze Age art. But then, very, very significantly, it's got a large extent of polissoirs. And polissoirs are Neolithic polished stone axe grinding grooves. Right, which is quite a mouthful. So the polished stone axes are the thing that six to 7,000 years ago, where the trees are chopped down. But they're also they're not just utilitarian. They're also, we think, they have a diplomatic or a religious function. The more kind of ornate of them, and we have this very, very large set of grooves, and there is. Struggling to confirm how unique it is. There are two or three in Scotland. This is the biggest by a significant factor. It's probably one of the biggest in Britain. And Irene I was meeting with this morning to talk over it. We're trying to work out if there's how common should these be? How far do you travel to grind a Neolithic polished stone axe? Do you travel for a day, a week? Given that there's only two or three in Scotland, is this the main Scottish one? or is it that we're not finding them? And so we have this center of pilgrimage, I think. So it's both utilitarian and a pilgrimage point where you're actively making a decision to come to grind these axes. And are you doing it at midnight? Are you doing it at summer solstice? And it's in this incredible bowl-like location between two major rivers with hills on a kind of a 360 hills and mountains. And you have this dome in the middle of a bigger basin. And clearly the hills, the mountain ridges have some kind of significance. Are they gods? You know, and you can imagine, and what we're, the big debate we're having is how many axes are there in, you know, a kind of 10-mile area, a 20-mile area? Are any of the axes that are ground there in the wider environs? And we don't think they are. We think people are walking for mile after mile after mile to come to this location, which is, and you know, the thing is unique in Scotland, maybe unique in Britain. How far does that go in terms of its significance? So that's very exciting. But that's that's volunteers. So I've been doing a day a month, a day a week, that kind of thing, as the weather permits, for the last 3 years. We begin backfilling tomorrow. But that's very good. That's very good. So yeah, there's but other things, digging a Pictish hill fort, digging a medieval castle.
Isn't that what Griffin helped with, the castle?
No, Griffin was digging on a Roman Iron Age elite settlement. So like a fort.
A fort. I knew I remembered it was some sort of bigger structure.
Yeah, so this is a kind of an elite family, but like a single house for the kind of elite family members. And that is contemporary with the Roman Empire. So the individuals are trading with Rome. It's one of those odd things. When during the Roman occupation in Scotland, if someone builds a defensive, or someone uses defensive architecture, it's not really defensive, if that makes sense. It's because the Romans could just knock it out, and the Romans wouldn't let someone have defensive architecture. So what you're really looking at is some kind of it's like driving a Humvee. You know, that's a military vehicle, but this isn't an individual. If you've got one for your personal use, you're not in the military. You're not using it for its intended purpose, but you are somehow kind of drawing
more like a stylistic choice.
Yeah, but equally, we think with these hill forts that they're trying to create the impression of a warrior aristocracy. So it's not as crude, but you can imagine. We all know individuals who, some you might know veterans, but we certainly know people who claim to be veterans, and they're drawing upon the authority of something that they don't have a legitimate claim to use. So architecture has a language that that communicates a message to people, and we are struggling to understand that after 2,000 years. But if you looked at mock baronial is a style in architecture here, or Scots baronial, where it's drawing upon medieval architectural trends for churches or castles, but it really isn't a church or a castle. It's just trying to communicate power, authenticity, heritage, without really having anything to back that up.
Got it.
You know.
Got it. Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of what I do, I mean, explicitly, I do the field schools over the summer, and I spread the money across the rest of the year doing other things. So, yeah, Griffin was at the King's Park field school, the excavation there. But, you know, equally, I've just done We did the castle, and this is a medieval castle that's turned into an 18th century garden. It's very odd. So the house, they move house, they have a castle, and they get money. They probably get money from empire. So probably from India, the kind of empire possessions in India, and they knock the castle down and build a bigger house, but they keep the castle as an element of their garden, like a folly. So you could walk around the garden and go, that's where we used to live. And it's, you know, it's what you do if you're seriously rich.
Do they have mini golf in Scotland?
Sorry, say that again.
Do they have mini golf in Scotland?
Yeah.
It reminds me of that, how it's just like there'd be like a little fake kind of castle thing.
In origins, 13th, 14th century, and then completely destroyed by 1780, 1800. But we found the doorway, we found the yard, and I'm digging that with local volunteers and the local school. So, you know, what else? Stirling, where I am, is actually the kind of the birthplace. So you know what plaid is. I mean, you're a Campbell. So do you take your tartan seriously?
No, I actually don't know anything about my Scottish heritage other than that I have it.
Right. Well, so your name Campbell, right, has a tartan, a family tartan, which you might call a plaid, right? So it's a specific pattern. Now, a lot of that is kind of, it's not made up, but it's exaggerated, right? And it's exaggerated to encourage people to buy tartan, right? So the people that come up, and actually I should say, not to mock it. So tartan is the traditional cloth of Highland Scotland, Highland Gaelic Scotland. It is specific tartans are connected to specific families. It gets associated with the Jacobites. So if you've seen Outlander, you know that the Jacobites are basically a rival royal family who keep trying to get the Scottish and English throne back. So the Jacobites launch a series of rebellions from the late 17th century all the way to 1746. And tartan becomes associated with Jacobites, right? Mm-hmm. And the British state are so scared of the Jacobites that they ban the wearing of tartan. It's actually a criminal act to wear tartan. And, you know, people are arrested, people are shot. It becomes a symbol of rebellion. Now, it also, once the Jacobites are dead and buried, it becomes incredibly fashionable, right? Because, you know, the way rebellion can become safe, it's like punks now. Punks are safe. So tartan becomes a symbol of rebellion, then it becomes safe. And because it becomes safe, it becomes fashionable, and the person and the kind of modern tartan industry where you might, you might say you need the Campbell tartan, and then the Campbell tartan, you might have three variants of the Campbell tartan. You might have a hunting tartan, a dining tartan, a military tartan, and that then means that you need to buy three kilts. And the person that comes up with all of that is based in Stirling. And over the summer, I was digging their weaving mill, so the origins of tartan, so just to kind of find out where that is, what survives in the ground. So I mean you can see that across the course of that I've been digging from Neolithic material all the way through to 18th century industrial stuff. So I just dig whatever I feel I'm interested in, whatever there is a particular aspect. My long-term research consistently that I do is kind of 1000 BC to 1000 AD, with a real focus on kind of 200 BC, 200 AD. So before the Romans, the Romans, and then the impact that the Romans have on Scottish society and how that changes. The introduction of Christianity, the introduction of literacy, and then all of that creates the kind of the political maps of Scotland, so the border between England and Scotland. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
That's so interesting about the tartan, because I actually now I'm like thinking, and I remember we had some sort of emblem on it, and then the tartan, yep, like in our house, like the Campbell tartan. And yep, I wonder if my dad still has that, because it's on his side. It's my dad's dad who's, yep, had the Scottish heritage. But also when you're excavating like the weaving mill like that, it's so funny because your evidence, and we were actually, I'm in a sacrifice and violence class with Dr. Hagen Klaus. I don't know if you're familiar with the name. He's a bioarchaeologist, so you probably not. But anyway, we were talking about, you know, what preserves in the archaeological record, and how we were talking about Vikings, and, you know, a lot of things were wood, and that doesn't really preserve. So yeah, it's funny how, you know, you're looking at a weaving mill, but there's so much context that's missing from the actual like textiles that they were producing. And I love archaeology, but I also sometimes am blown away by what we are missing in the record. And I guess that's where like ethnohistories, like you were talking about, come in.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I take is that basically history allows lies to be told, you know, because whoever writes a history is, you know, you're writing a version of events probably to justify a current political situation. So, you know, it's this kind of, right, so, you know, in kind of preppy schools in America, so if you think about Clueless, right?
Yeah.
Those plaid skirts are worn by the kind of the young women, right?
Yeah.
The reason that happens is that in 19th century America, kilts were worn by young men. Mm-hmm. And there's a transition from the kilts being worn by elite young men to becoming elite young women. Mm-hmm. And that's undocumented. And how, and now, you know, so that whole, and basically, how do you go from something that you would be shot in 1748 in Scotland, you'd be shot for wearing a kilt. And yeah, how does that same material, that same costume, end mm-hmm. up being appropriated by young women in kind of elite educational institutions? So all of that's missing, let alone the last 200 years worth of kilts, mm-hmm. Because it's all disposable, it's all rotted, it all vanishes. I think, but then the facts that you do get from archaeology are incontrovertible, but of course that's where our interpretation comes in. Mm-hmm. Do you know what vitrified forts are? Have you heard of those before?
I have not.
These are really cool, right? The Scotland has the highest density of vitrified forts. So these are, so a fort is obviously a defensive enclosure. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if you have a fort with a timber-laced rampart, so a timber infrastructure in a wooden wall, in a stone wall, and the timber infrastructure allows the wall to go 2-3 meters high, so it becomes much, much higher. If you set fire to one of those and maintain the fire for, you know, 2-3 days, maybe a week, the temperature within the core of the rampart can reach such extremes that the stones melt, the stone begins to melt and fuses with the other stones.
Oh,
so
my
a process
goodness.
called vitrification. Now, the question is, who's doing that? That's so incredibly violent. And we've got early medieval records of people firing hill forts. And where people have dug those hill forts, they've found vitrified material. So what you're really looking at is in effect, this kind of the equivalent of a war crime. You've captured the fort, you've set fire to it, you've maintained the fire for days. So you can imagine smoke during the day, visible for miles. The bonfire, if you can imagine a bonfire, maybe 20, 30, 40 meters across, the whole of a hilltop on fire. for days. You can see how intense that is. Now, of course, enemy action, right? That makes sense where we have a historical context, but we also get it in the kind of prehistoric period. And in the prehistoric period, we have no written records to explain what's happening. Mm-hmm. So is it enemy action, or are they doing it themselves? Is it ritual destruction of a fort? So is it ritual construction and then ritual destruction? And all of this is particularly fascinating because how on earth do we know? And all we have is the fact that it was set fire to, but the firing was so violent. I mean, it's basically the best evidence for violence in the Scottish prehistoric record, because it is fiery destruction. So yes, absolutely.
Personally, do you think that if you were to hypothesize, which do you think it is, enemies or ritual?
Well, I have published on this and I hedge my bets. I think that in small scale forts, in an AD context, it's enemy action. Mm-hmm. But there are one or two forts that date to kind of 500, 200 BC. They're absolutely enormous. They're on incredibly high hills. The ramparts are 6 meters wide, 2 to 3 meters high. They don't have entrances. They're not associated with internal settlement. They're stretching for hundreds of meters. So it's the rampart that set fire to rather than the hilltop. And it's clear that the prevailing winds would require you to do this over several attempts. Mm-hmm. So I think you're looking at ritual construction. Have you heard of the European term Wirkschanze? So it's a kind of a ritual enclosure, like a nemeton. So this is a kind of an area of thought that people are building heavily built ritual enclosure, so you can't see what's going in. They're not defensive, they're just designed to be screened so people can't see what's going on. And maybe the construction is ritual, like a massive amount of volume of labor, construction materials, timber, and then in the same way, like a pyramid being built, absolutely enormous volume of material consumed, but then set fire to it. And if you thought about, say, Tutankhamun's tomb, all that wealth, it's not destroyed, mm-hmm. but it's sealed. So maybe the destruction of this fort that you build up as a gift to the gods. But that really excites me, the vitrified forts.
Has there been any evidence in any of them of like burned human remains, like as if people were in there? Because I feel like for me that would be strong evidence that it was like enemies, because then people would die inside.
No, we've got a handful of odd deposits. So there's there was a human skull in a well in one of them, so just the skull. But no kind of trapped individuals. But the difficulty is, I don't think we've dug enough of them. There is a fort in the north of England where there's a series of bodies from within collapsed ramparts, and we've definitely got evidence for people defending hill forts, but not setting fire. Not the vitrified ones. The two sets of evidence are separate.
Got it.
So unfortunately.
Yeah. Because I'm a bones person. So I always think about the skeletal remains.
Yeah, no, I mean I think the trouble is a lot of the soils in Scotland are quite acidic. So you need very specific conditions for the bones to survive, unfortunately.
Yes. Yeah. And then is the other thing, you mentioned this earlier, when you're excavating, because it's quite wet there, is weather kind of a prohibiting factor for certain digs?
It does rain. It does rain in Scotland. We don't get long, stable seasons. if that makes sense. So our summer can be warm, but it can be cold, and it can be windy, and it can be wet, and it might change from day to day. So the solution for that is either good waterproofs or a series of gazebos. And you know, Griffin, Griffin will tell you, I basically have a series of gazebos just so if it rains for an hour, it rains for an afternoon, we just carry on digging underneath them. But the biggest problem is really if you get your boots muddy and you begin to slip and slide. But the gazebos, I got I've got massive amounts of gazebos now. I can cover the whole of the site. And well, it was the only way. I back in 2019, we had some freakish weather where it rained almost every second day, and it was really heavy, and we couldn't do anything. You know, we would do an hour or two, then it would rain. So I just had to buy the gazebos, and that way, you know, we can carry on working. So that was fine. But you need to be. I mean, a lot of the stuff I'm doing at the moment with volunteers, we cancel a lot of days because if it's not fun, it's not worth doing. You know, so and you know, there's a probably a tenth of the days get cancelled over the course of the year because the weather there's no point in climbing onto a half hour walk onto a moor where it's going to rain all the way there, rain on you while you're there, and then rain on you on the way back. So that's no fun. That's no fun at all.
We have a bit of rain here today, and my roommate's cat is sitting in the window right next to me. She's just watching the rain through the view.
You have to let her in.
Huh? Oh, she's in. She's sitting on the inside of the window, staring at the outside. Right.
We have two cats, and so I always get up early. I'm up about 5:30 every morning, and I do a couple of hours of work. So the cats get out. So my routine is get up, coffee on, computer on, cats out. That's it every morning. And then they go out for a couple of hours, then they come back in for the breakfast. And then they sleep the rest of the day. And if they're asleep, they'll be awake later on this evening running around. But they like going out for a smell and a kind of a prowl about. So, yeah.
Do they bring you back gifts?
They used to. We used to let them out all the time. And, they would bring back everything. Half-eaten mice, half-eaten birds, and it just—it's not so much. I don't object to a wild animal bringing in something that's doing its nature. That's fine. They don't need to kill anything because we feed them. So I object to the loss of the loss of the birds.
So you mentioned a lot about the volunteers. I know partly because I read about it on your profile, but also Griffin mentioned that community engagement is really important to you and working with local groups and volunteers. What do you think the benefits are for that, especially in a smaller place like Scotland where everything, for example, I feel like here, you can have some community engagement, but it's not so widespread because we have such a big community. In a place where you have a smaller community, do you feel like it has real impacts in the tangible impacts that you can see in your community?
There's lots of thinking about this, but you know, this concept of placemaking, you know, where people begin to value where they live and how do you get them to value where they live? And for me, that begins with understanding the past of where you live, to recognize it's not simply a place to kind of sleep and kind of go to work, but the place has roots. So you have that where you take, I mean, and again, you know, this works in Scotland, where basically every square inch has history going back 10,000 BC. Except if it's been built on, so you can go out, put a spade in the ground. So if you encourage a community to research its past and find out something about the thing or on their back door, then they're more interested in their location. But equally, it has the benefit of, as long as you do it properly, so improve the management, improve the understanding, maybe improve the interpretation, then it becomes a place that people want to come to because there's something there. Then you have the kind of the whole just meeting new people, getting those people outside. There's this whole thing in Scotland. We don't have a trespass law in Scotland. You mean go anywhere, right? Except people's gardens, you know, and you know, you don't want to walk through someone's crop in a field. But basically, treat the country with respect. We can go anywhere. We can walk anywhere. We can do anything. But people are always a bit nervous about exercising those rights. But there's something really nice about having formal permissions to be somewhere, to be digging on someone's ground, to be researching something, and that sense of almost kind of being special because you've got the permission to be there. That's quite good. Yeah. It's quite good meeting people. And then that whole business of confidence building, you know, that you're actually teaching people new skills. They're confident because now they're kind of, oh, I'm doing archaeology. That feels really exciting. It's really special. So I think there's a whole range of benefits to doing it. And of course, if I'm kind of speaking with my very limited budget researcher hat on, this is a way to get research done very cheaply. Yeah. We all have fun together. Mm-hmm. I mean, the hours are more limited. I tend to do 10 to 3. So 10 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon with volunteers. Mm-hmm. And it makes it easier for everybody to do. If you've got to get kids off to school, you can do that. If you've got to work part-time, do some emails in the morning, you can do that. And also, it's clearly not a job of work. So no one's exhausted at the end of it. So the whole thing is more relaxed. It's fun. And I mean, I think we could eulogize archaeology and talk about how important it is. And I think it is important, but it's not brain surgery. It's not social services. Mm-hmm. It's not nursing. It's something I think a civilized society should do. Yeah. But of course, if we expect a civilized society to pay for it, what do taxpayers get? So here is a thing for taxpayers to get a little bit back for what they pay for, and you know, so I think there's just benefits all round. It's interesting. I mean, the hard commercial benefits of the field school. There's Griffin coming from the States. We've Australians, Canadians, Europeans, all coming to Stirling, all bringing kind of you know, in effect, that's exports, that's foreign currency coming into Stirling, doing something they wouldn't have come to Stirling otherwise. So I think the benefits are obvious and very tangible, but you know, the proof is in the pudding, really. What does wider society think about it? But then again, that's our job to convince them that it is worth doing. And I don't think we can ever be complacent that you are, that what we do is worthwhile, and we've always got to be alert to proselytize for it. So
yeah, I think that's really fascinating, and I think it's a really cool thing that I hope more people do. I think the community engagement is really important. I think kind of one of my final questions is, what are some of your favorite things about Scotland or Stirling in specific, your favorite things that you would tell people about that have never been there that might convince them to go visit?
Well, I think Scotland is just an incredible place. We're very friendly. We have kind of the world's largest cultural festival, the Edinburgh Festival. We have incredible hills and mountains. This whole right to roam thing, which is, you know, the no trespass law. You can go anywhere. You can go swimming in our rivers, in our seas. No one's going to shout at you. very friendly, I think, in terms of kind of Stirling. Stirling's this astonishing medieval kind of defended city. It's on a former frontier. The border keeps changing in Scotland as we're kind of fighting each other, fighting the English, and Stirling sits on the frontier. So you want to understand Scottish politics, Scottish military history, there's no better place to do it at Stirling.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think
no problem at all.
Scotland's definitely been on my bucket list. I'm just waiting to like not be a broke student to be able to travel. There are so many places that I would love to go. Scotland,
well, you need to come home.
Yes, I know. It's funny. I actually, until you mentioned that, I was like, oh yeah, I am Scottish. I kind of forgot that.
That's okay. Don't worry.
Yeah, just to show how little we appreciate our heritage.
Yeah, no, don't worry. Don't worry. It's you're always welcome here.
Thank you. Does your family have a tartan?
Yeah, strictly speaking, I'm a MacDonald. Cook is my step-grandfather's name. So that's just kind of one of those things in the couple of generations ago. But no, I'm really a MacDonald. So cool. There you go.
I'll have to look it up. I'll post it.
Yeah, no, don't worry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, I think that's all I had to ask. I really appreciate you taking the time.
No problem at all. It was a pleasure, Gabby. Thank you very much.